Are you tired of hearing that publishing is filled with gatekeepers who are impossible to gain access to? So are we. That's why we're arranging for you to meet them at our 2025 Deep Dive Virtual Retreat, which is happening on the 1st and 2nd of February. We've reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners from across the world as possible. But if you loved the breakout room sessions and workshops from the 10-week deep dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the 2-day intensive. Plus, this year we're focusing on giving you access to way more gatekeepers, so expect to hear from agents and editors who've worked on some of the last decade's best-selling books. Subscribe to our Substack or follow us on Instagram so that you can be the first to be in the know as we begin to reveal our incredible lineup each week. Mark the dates in your calendars, especially the 29th of November, which is the early bird pricing registration day, which you definitely don't want to miss. The last beta reader matchup of the year is happening now in November, with the matchup emails going out on the 2nd of December. Please note we won't have another one until after February of 2025. You know the drill by now. 3,000 words of your work will be critiqued by those writing in a similar genre and or time zone as you critique their own work in return. If you already have a writing group or beta readers who've looked at your work before, it's not considered cheating to get fresh eyes on your pages. Critique fatigue can set in when the same people read the same revisions too many times, meaning they anticipate all the action rather than truly being surprised or delighted by it. Give yourself the gift of good critique this holiday season and sign up before the 2nd of December. Go to my website, biancamaray.com, and look for the Beta Reader Matchup tab. Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. We'll be kicking off today's episode with our usual Books with Hooks segment, after which we'll go to today's guest. Today's guest is the former editor of the New York Times' Motherlode and the co-host of the hashtag AmWriting podcast, as well as the author of How to Be a Happier Parent, In Her Boots, and the instant New York Times bestseller and Reese's Book Club pick, The Chicken Sisters. She lives with her family on a small farm in Lyme, New Hampshire, but retains an abiding love for her childhood in Texas and Kansas. It's my pleasure to welcome KJ Del Antonia. KJ, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm so excited to be here. I am an extremely regular listener.
Ah, that's always wonderful to hear from authors. So thank you so much for that. I'm really excited to have you here today. So for our listeners, the book we're talking about is The Chicken Sisters. And you've probably been seeing that all over the place because it's been made into a Hallmark original series. We've been seeing tons of things about the actors and promos for that, which has been really exciting because when you read a book, you have these characters in mind, you visualize them, and then you see it adapted and it kind of comes to life on the screen. So, for those of you who aren't familiar with the book, I'm just reading you the flap copy. Three generations, two chicken shacks, one recipe for disaster. In tiny Merrimack, Kansas, chicken Mimis and chicken Frannies have spent a century vying to serve up the best fried chicken in the state. And the legendary feud between their respective owners, the Moores and the Pogacellos, has lasted just as long. No one feels the impact more than 35-year-old widow Amanda Moore, who grew up working for her mom at Mimi's before scandalously marrying Frank Pogacello and changing sides to work at Franny's. Dun, dun, dun. Tired of being caught in the middle, Amanda sends an SOS to Food Wars, the reality TV restaurant competition that promises $100,000 to the winner. But in doing so, she launches both families out of the frying pan and directly into the fire. The last thing Brooklyn-based organizational guru May Moore, Amanda's sister, wants is to go home to Kansas. But when her career implodes, helping the fading Mimis look good on Food Wars becomes May's best chance to reclaim the limelight, even if doing so pits her against Amanda and Franny's. Yet when family secrets become public knowledge, the sisters must choose. Will they fight with each other or for their heritage. So lots of high stakes. We're always talking about high stakes and why something matters. And by just reading this flap copy, you can get the high stakes and why it matters. So KJ, before we dive into chatting about the book, I just want to discuss, this was your first debut fiction title. Holy hell, to debut this way with fiction. Can you just take us through that journey to publication, getting an agent, getting published, and what that must have been like for you?
So I have thoughts about the debuting this way that go beyond that as well. So I was already represented in nonfiction. I was a writer with the New York Times. So I was in a sort of a different position than most of the people that I help query, which is that I knew that this query would get read. And I knew that it would get read quickly. And I knew that the novel, you know, which was obviously finished when I queried, would also get read. But I suspected that I had exactly one shot to switch from nonfiction into fiction. So the stakes were high there as well. So I really worked hard to get this novel as good as I could possibly get it, both on my own and working with a book coach, Jenny Nash, before I sent it out. And then I sent it to my nonfiction agent, knowing that she did not represent very much fiction, and what she did represent tended to be very much on the literary side. So I didn't expect her to want to represent it. And I was right, she did not. But she offered to refer me to someone else within her same agency. And that person ended up being my agent. And it was a very quick success, but it was very calculated. Like, I knew that if I went to them with something on the weaker side, they were going to go, oh, well, you know, she's a nonfiction. At least that was my suspicion. Anyway, and then we had this novel, which was in pretty polished shape. So it went out and it ended up as a preempt with Putnam. And I had my original editor there, Margot, was wonderful for the Chicken Sisters. And I have since checked off the bingo card of authordom of having your editor quit and being moved on to a different author. So, yeah. And then obviously, I mean, everything came up roses for this book. And I've written two since, and neither has been as successful. So I got all the feels about that, man.
Yeah, that's the thing that people don't realize is when you debut big, you set the bar really high. And, you know, it's so hard to do better than that. And then you're like, what? Is it just downhill from there? And then, you know, you have authors like me who debuted quietly, and with every, you know, successive book, you're like hoping to finally get the New York Times bestseller. I think it means that no matter where we are in our journey, we are dissatisfied, right? It doesn't matter.
I think so. Yeah, I think we are always sitting around raising our bars, and there's a little mini Reese's Book Club author club of like, oh, this is, you know, this will probably be my most successful book. There are exceptions to that rule within the research, because there's hierarchies within everything, right? So, you know, I'm having this really peculiar moment of having, once again, enormous success with my first book, but my third book, Playing the Witch Card, which is the obvious October book, it doesn't get as much attention because it didn't have that kind of success, although it's really, it's just as good. It really is. I swear to you, you know, non-me commentators have said as much. So you just kind of don't know when that lightning is going to strike. And trust me that I love the lightning and I love this book. And it's been really fun to come back to it in this way. But it's also kind of really like my outside on Instagram right now looks extraordinary. My inside is a mess because I've just, you know, spent months on a draft that I'm not sure it's ever going to see the light of day.
Yeah. Yeah. Listen, this is the shit no one tells you about writing, people. And, you know, same as KJ, I lost my editor at Putnam with my second book. I then came out with a third book with an entirely different publisher. Loved that editor. Have just lost her. And the fourth book is coming out next year. So, you know, this is how it goes. And every time you lose an editor, it is called being orphaned. And it is devastating because you build a relationship with them because they're the ones who are so passionate about the book and they're driving the sales force and they're telling everybody about it. And so being handed to somebody else, it sounds pretty simple, but it actually is a big thing in an author's life. But it's happening more and more. It's becoming more the norm these days, right?
I don't think I even know anyone who hasn't been orphaned in that way. I really am. I'm going to make a little bingo card of authors, and that is totally going to be on it. But it just really really is bringing home to me this rule that you never judge your insides by somebody else's outsides. And as much as I've tried on Instagram to be like, and also, you know, I'm not having a great writery moment, I'm also like, you know, sharing all this fantastic Chicken Sisters stuff. And I know that it is pushing the buttons for other authors the same way when I, you know, when I see you with your crowds, you know, at some of your events, I'm like, I never get a crowd, you know. It's anyway, we all do it. And I know that I'm successful, but I mostly don't feel it.
I love that we're having this discussion, which was not on my bingo card for today, but it is important because there are the times that I have gone on tour and I walk into a bookstore and there is no one there, which is kind of preferable because then I'm like, okay, I can go back to my hotel room, get back into my pajamas, open a bag of chips and, you know, just cry myself to sleep. But then that one person will wander off the street to get out of the damn rain and you know they're not there for you and they're not going to buy the book, but there they are sitting in front of you. So you've got to go through the whole spiel. So all of these things are on the author bingo card. Not everything that is on the author bingo card is going to be something great, is going to be something amazing. There are incredible things and very few people get to tick off Reese's Book Club, but there are just as many shitty things. And we're not saying this to discourage you. We're just saying it to say, this is the author life and you need to be prepared for all of it.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I guarantee you that Emily Henry has bad days. Like that's anyway. So, but now we get to talk about some of the good stuff, right? And I'm happy. I'm super excited to do that too.
Right. So what I want to dive into is whenever we speak about world building on the podcast, we tend to associate it with fantasy novels or with science fiction novels or something dystopian. But what really hit me with this novel was the amount of world building that had to go into it, either before you started writing it or as you were writing it, you were going, oh, shit, I don't know what's happening with this. I need to figure this out. I need to work out family trees. So for our listeners, this takes place in a very particular kind of town. It's a small town, but you know, the two feuding sort of Chicken Sisters come from a long line of feuding family members. And we go back to like grandparents, great grandparents, and there's this one marrying that one and that one marrying this one. So can you speak a bit about world building when it comes to normal fiction that is not fantasy based? So it doesn't need to be this, you know, what is the magic system of the world, but certainly knowing as the author, what does this town look like? What are the dynamics? What are the politics? And where do these feuds come from over however many generations?
Yeah, I've also written one with magic world building at this point too. So I can compare. This was easier, but also really complicated. But one of the reasons that it was easier is that there is a real history to these restaurants. They really exist in a small town in Kansas where my parents grew up and I grew up seeing them. So I had a mental vision. And what I have realized since is that I almost need a mental vision of a town and a street. Like I need to draw a little map. I need to know where things are. And that is just for like describing where people are in time. But I also need a mental vision of a house. And I typically just take something from my real life and put it in there. But you are absolutely right that this had to go back generations. And let me say that what I did first was to do too much. I could tell you in great detail the history of the liquor laws and their differences between Kansas and Missouri, which these towns are on the Kansas-Missouri line. My editor was like, you know what? No one wants to know that. So yeah, I had a huge amount of backstory that ends up getting pared down into just a few lines here and there. But I think that it has to happen. And I have also learned that for me, I can't name a character without knowing what their mother would have named them. And what their mother would have named them has something to do with what her mother named her. And so on and so forth. So I've learned to do that without actually putting it in the book, but I do have to do it because that is how, you know, that is how that works. Like if you had a really hard name to spell, maybe you give your child something easier because you think that was torture. Anyway, it is world building. It is not magic system building, but it is really important and it gives you a basis from which to grow the characters.
Yeah, you know, it's like an iceberg. Not everything's going to find its way onto the page. There's this whole thing under the water that the reader perhaps doesn't see, but you can't get to the part that they do see without knowing all of that, at least as the author. So was it a case of you sat first and mapped that all out and had it very clear in your mind, so you knew all of that before you began writing? Or was it a case of, I'm going to write, and each time I need to figure something out, I'm going to stop and flesh out what I know more? Because for me, I can't sit and work it all out beforehand. I'm a needs-based world builder.
I definitely didn't work it out all ahead of time. I mean, I have this cheat in that the restaurants, I mean, they don't exist, and the history is totally different than what is in the book. But I think the cheat here is that they've been growing in my head since I was little, because they were something that I was curious about since I was little. When I have done it since, it's really been mostly needs-based. For playing the witch card, I needed a small Kansas town, and I had kind of one in mind, and I was able to drive through it while touring, and I put that in quotes, for In Her Boots, which entailed driving from Texas to Kansas in a car, which I did partly so I could stop and take some pictures of this town. But I didn't know what I needed until I started writing. I just kind of built a little reservoir that I could use.
Okay, so I want to discuss what I think is a sneaky prologue, because you know on the podcast we have this thing about prologues and sneaky prologues. But before I do that, I'm actually going to show KJ this picture of her book, which has been devoured. It looks like it's been gnawed by rats at the bottom. And this is because yesterday I was looking after a good friend's two French bulldogs, who I suspect saw this on my bed, red chicken, and decided to see if it tasted like chicken. So this is looking very lived in, but I mean, they ate quite a bit of it, KJ, so I think it tasted good. Right, so this book starts with the kind of sneaky prologue. It's not called a prologue. And it goes, the hit TFC series Food Wars is back, and this time it's personal. We're looking for rival restaurants with a deeper connection, married chefs, best friends with dueling taco trucks. If you're a restaurant owner or worker who shares a bond with the crew at a competing restaurant in your town, we want to hear from you. And so it goes, it lays it out of what they're looking for in the show. And then we get a bunch of drafted emails from Amanda to, you know, Sabrina at the Food Channel. And it's a draft. And then we see the draft is deleted. And then there's another draft. And that draft is deleted. And then there's another draft. And so we finally see what is sent. And it's so interesting to start in this way, because I thought it was such a clever way of giving the reader context, kind of backstory, but without making it seem like backstory. So was that your intention in the drafting process of those emails?
Who has a language barrier with loved ones that they see during the holiday season? My husband's family is Italian, and when the men are in the kitchen cooking, and yes, it is all the men in his family that cook, they sprinkle in their Italian sayings, like one of them asks, does it need more salt, or how much time does it need? And the other says, quanto basta, which means as much as needed, aka lay off me, it'll be ready when it's ready, with the right amount of seasoning. Memories of good food, sharing language, and warm kitchens is so special at this time of year. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app, and truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Italian. Rosetta Stone is a trusted expert for 30 years, with millions of users and 25 languages offered: Spanish, French, Italian, German, Korean, Chinese, so many more. Another important thing is fast language acquisition. Rosetta Stone immerses you in so many ways. There are no English translations, so you really learn to speak, listen, and think in that language. It's an intuitive process. You're picking up a language naturally, first with words and then phrases and sentences. There's speech recognition. They have a built-in true accent feature that gives you feedback on your pronunciation. It's convenient, flexible learning, anytime, anywhere. Learn on the mobile app or on your desktop. And it's amazing value. Lifetime membership for all 25 languages. Very impressive. So don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a short time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's Lifetime Membership Holiday Special. This offer will not last. Visit rosettastone.com/today. That's unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your holiday offer at rosettastone.com/today, today, for yourself or as a gift that keeps giving. If you have a busy life like me, you're always thinking of ways to spend less time in the minutiae of a task and have more time to actually do the thing. And that's why I love Notion, and I've integrated the Notion desktop app into my family and home life. I'm obsessed with my kids' activity tracker. If you're like me, we're juggling hockey and gymnastics, swimming, music, skiing, and camps between two kids. That's a lot to schedule. I also really love our Notion travel planner. We've lined up a Disney trip for next year, and I know I have a lot to juggle with all the apps and to-dos just within that plan. Planning alone, and my family health binder. Having a single spot to access our family records and information is so useful. You never know when you're going to need it all and really fast. So you can customize these or grab templates that others have originated. I've chosen to use it as my home digital filing cabinet and planner. They have a new function to add to their already stellar project bases, AI integration. The new Notion AI is a single AI tool that does it all. Search across Notion and other apps, generate docs in your own style, analyze PDFs and images, and chat with you about anything. Notion AI is designed to protect your privacy. Notion AI's partners are contractually prohibited from using your data to train their AI models. And Notion respects the permissions of your content, so will only reference content that you have access to. You guys know I'm anti-AI for creative writing, but very pro-AI for life hacks, marketing, and life productivity. Notion is an incredible tool to track habits, manage expenses, and build your own databases for home or work. It has templates and planners that will help you aesthetically and practically design your life. Try Notion for free now when you go to notion.com/TSNOTYAW. That's all lowercase letters, notion.com/TSNOTYAW to try the powerful, easy to use Notion AI today. And when you use our link, you're supporting our show. That's notion.com/TSNOTYAW.
Yes. I don't think I thought of it until I started to write them. Once I knew that this was going to be I think I knew from the beginning that this was going to be a reality TV competition between the two restaurants. And I started with that ad. I don't know that those are the first words I wrote, but it was always the beginning. And then I very quickly realized that by creating those draft emails, which it's really hard not to read people's email too, like they're little, you know, little potato chips and you just kind of, so they have that already sort of built in. But yeah, I very quickly realized that I could use that, you know, the fact that there's a word limit in the request for the email. And then the idea that Amanda would be trying to give them, like, she would want to give them this whole history. And of course, she can't. So the fact that she'd then pick and choose, like, okay, in this email, it's the history of the restaurants. And in this email, it's the family history of the existing family's feud. And in this one, and then finally, in the end, it's just a very, you know, simple and straightforward one. But yeah, that was calculated. And I don't know if I'll ever think of such a good idea again.
Yeah. So this is the thing about being experimental with your writing, is that there are different ways to give backstory. There are different ways to give exposition, and be experimental with it. Play around with it. Say, how can I do it in a way that's fresh and that's new and that delivers it without the reader even knowing that they get it? And it was only after I'd read all of it that I was like, huh, this is such an interesting way of doing that. And I wouldn't have thought about that. So definitely for our listeners, have fun with the way that you do these kinds of things. Something else that KJ did so perfectly is in the email, Amanda's writing from the first person perspective. So she's using her own voice, her own sort of vocabulary, her own sort of stilted phrasing. But then the rest of the book is written in like third person close. So you get the narrator's voice rather than Amanda's voice. And that was obviously very intentional. So I'm always saying to our listeners, when you choose between first person or third person, it needs to be intentional. Why am I doing one over the other? And if I changed it, how would that change the narration? And we can tell very clearly from those first person emails how very different the narration, the narrative voice would be if we got it in Amanda's first person as opposed to the author's third person voice. So can you speak a bit about that as well?
Yes, I've also had the experience of changing a book from third person to third person or back and forth, or yeah, a variety of exciting messing around with that. I wrote this in third person close in part because that is my favorite way to read. And also because it is dual POV, and dual POV that are both in first person can be very confusing. But these two characters needed to be very much equal on the page. And Then the final thing is that, yes, I don't know that I could sustain Amanda as a character, especially in the beginning, is very unconfident. She's very hesitant. She's very uncertain about the various decisions that she has made, but she also doesn't want to admit that to herself. And I think I would find that very hard to sustain in the first person. I think part of the reason that this is in third person close is that one of these characters would sound more like me, and the other one very much would not. And yet I have equal understanding and sympathy with them both. If I had written May, who's the character that I more easily relate to her life choices, in the first person and Amanda in the third, I think it would have come through that May was more important to me, which she was in the beginning, but she doesn't end up in the end. So yeah, that would not have been the right choice. And I never did it that way. This one's been in third person close the whole time. And interestingly, in the TV series, they added an omniscient narrator. I think because it's a hard story to tell without that.
Yeah, that's the intentionality we're looking at. So in my second novel, I wrote two characters from sort of first person and one character from the third person. And in my New York Times takedown review, which ripped that book to shreds, I was told that I wrote the one character from the third person because I viewed her as less than the other two characters. And that couldn't have been further from the truth. It was that a first person character can only tell the reader what they themselves know about their situation, about their circumstances. And when you write in third person, you as the narrator are able to convey things that the character themselves is not aware of. And so again, that's something to really keep in mind, because you just said, you know, Amanda's a certain way, but she doesn't see herself that way. And certainly, you know, we are all unreliable narrators in our own stories. So we would portray ourselves a certain way that maybe you want the reader to know that that isn't exactly the truth. And that's when you might want to play around with third person.
Right. And sometimes you need that. Like you want to only have the narrator's perspective on why they're making the choices that they're doing and what they see as the reasons that other people are making the choices that they're making, because their evolution is going to make them, you know, realize things that are different, and that's going to matter. So it just depends on the story that you're telling. And like I said, I've had to switch it around multiple times in the other books that I've written, and I don't think to their detriment. Sometimes you know and sometimes you don't.
Yeah, I've done that as well. Hop backwards and forwards until I find my entryway in to figure out, okay, this is the best narrative voice. Something you've just said now leads to the next question. So when you have a multi-POV novel, you know, each character needs to have high stakes. What's at stake? Why does it matter that they do this thing? If they don't do this thing, what is going to happen? And then, of course, you want the character's arc. You want them to go on a journey. Who they are at the end of the book needs to be different to who they were at the beginning of the book. This is true for most stories. Obviously, there are always stories in which the character stays completely the same, but they affect change around them. But for most stories, with this book, it was very clear early on what was at stake for Amanda, what was at stake for May, why they needed to do this, and then how the stakes got up, and then their character arc. But this is so much harder when you've got two main characters. And so you've only got 40,000 words to develop each of them, to be in their interiority, their emotionality as you take them through it. Whereas if you only have one character in a novel, you have the entire novel to do that. So can you speak a bit about setting it up for yourself up front, what the stakes were, making it clear on the page what their wants and their needs are? Because I think that's so important in the first act to tip the dominoes over and to drive the plot forward.
So to some extent, this has become a lot easier to explain because I've spent a fair amount of time talking about this book and thinking about it. So what I struggle to remember is how much of this was intentional and how much of it I had to find my way to. But especially looking at it now, these two characters are very, what they want and what they need to learn is completely in opposition to each other. And it is kind of funny because it was sort of my way of saying that there's no right choice here, which of course is one of their primary goals, is for the other to admit that they were right all along. So Amanda needs to give herself permission to leave this small town. May needs to realize that there's something to be said for coming back to the small town. So they have this opposing journey, which turned out to work extremely well. But yeah, it's very difficult to snug it in to 40,000 words. And it meant for me that there's almost no side character story here. Both the mother and the mother-in-law also have very small arcs, but they are in the book small and direct and fairly precise. And in an earlier draft, one of Amanda's kids in particular also had a big arc, and that had to come out. There just wasn't room. So what turns out is that all of that side character stuff has to really stay underneath and in the background in order to have a dual POV two-story book that is within, you know, the 100,000 word. I think this is like 106,000 words, which is a little long. And one of the things that's been a joy to see in watching them adapt it for TV is that they could bring out a bunch of secondary character stories. And some of them feed on things that I had and some of them don't.
Yeah. And so what KJ was just speaking about now was in terms of one needing to give herself permission to leave, one needing to realize there's something to be said for coming home. That's in terms of their character arc and the themes of the novel. But up front, what she does really well is she sets it up why each of them needs to do this contest. So Amanda wants to bring in more business. The business is failing. You know, things are not going well. She has her needs for wanting to do it. And her sister is, you know, she's working on another show and she doesn't really think her sister, well, she actually doesn't want her sister to be a part of it. And she doesn't think her sister will be a part of it. But suddenly her sister gets booted out of that. And so she needs to validate herself by moving on to something else. So it was really important upfront to set up what each character wants, what they need, and what's at stake, because everything that follows comes from those wants and needs and what's at stake, because it's plot forward story. Because what we often see emerging writers do is go, oh, this is what my character wants, this is what they need, but then they have a plot that has got absolutely nothing to do with what those characters want and need. So the wants and needs have got to tip the dominoes forward, right, KJ?
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And can I just say that I've made that mistake in subsequent drafts of subsequent novels of having the emotional arc and the plot arc have really no relationship to each other. And it's terrible. And I will never again draft an entire book that way, I say boldly and determinedly and probably incorrectly.
Put that on your bingo cards, everybody, because that is exactly something you are going to do all over again. You'll write a book and you'll be like, I think I know what I'm doing. And you'll begin writing another book and get halfway through and be like, oh, shit, I don't know what this character wants. I don't know what their emotional needs are. I don't know what's at stake. So another thing to put on your list is you'll think you know what you're doing, but actually you don't. KJ, we're out of time. It was so wonderful chatting with you. For our listeners, we're going to link to The Chicken Sisters as well as KJ's other books on our bookshop.org affiliate page. If you buy the books there, you support the podcast and independent bookstores at the same time. Thank you so much, KJ.
Thank you. This was super fun. I love listening to you interview, and being interviewed by you is, you know, obviously just as good.
A reminder that this is an unscripted program and our conversations have been edited and condensed and is not a full picture of our feedback or conversation directly with each author. As always, refer back to our written notes for the fulsome picture. Carly Waters and Cece Lira are agents at PS Literary Agency, but their work on this podcast is not affiliated with the agency, and the views expressed by Carly and Cece on this podcast are solely that of them as podcast co-hosts and do not necessarily reflect the views, opinions, policies, or position of PS Literary Agency. A reminder about all the ways that you can support us as a show: rate us 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, tell your writing friends about us. We'd love to help as many writers as possible. And follow us on our Substack newsletter. Get our stacked newsletter on a weekly basis, bonus videos, articles, essays, advice, and more. You can find it at theshitaboutwriting.substack.com. That's theshitaboutwriting.substack.com.
And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes. Are you tired of hearing that publishing is filled with gatekeepers who are impossible to gain access to? So are we. That's why we're arranging for you to meet them at our 2025 Deep Dive Virtual Retreat, which is happening on the 1st and 2nd of February. We've reverted back to a weekend format so that we can accommodate as many of our listeners from across the world as possible. But if you loved the breakout room sessions and workshops from the 10-week deep dive, don't worry. We'll still be including sessions like those before and after the 2-day intensive. Plus, this year, we're focusing on giving you access to way more gatekeepers. So expect to hear from agents and editors who've worked on some of the last decade's best-selling books. Subscribe to our Substack or follow us on Instagram so that you can be the first to be in the know as we begin to reveal our incredible lineup each week. Mark the dates in your calendars, especially the 29th of November, which is the early bird pricing registration day, which you definitely don't want to miss. Are you looking for the perfect gift for the writer in your life? Are you the favorite writer in your life and you want to gift yourself something awesome? Then come take a look at the Ultimate Planner for Writers for 2025. It not only allows you to plan for your regular day-to-day with hourly time slots, it also allows you to brainstorm, research, plot, outline, do scene planning, and vision boarding all in one. And it's available as a physical planner or as an e-planner. Check out Bianca Murray and find the Planner for Writers tab for more information. Remember to order early to avoid the end of year rush.